And welcome to the sixth episode of the Historic Prison Podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello. So, let's jump right into today's history section. We are delighted to be joined by two historians. Firstly, we welcome Dr. James Rogers, who is a fellow at the London School of Economics and the host of the World Wars podcast on the History Channel, as well as working with the BBC. And we also welcome Dr. Ian Johnson, all the way across the pond from the University of Notre Dame. Ian is a professor of Nazi and Soviet corporations throughout the Second World War and is one of the world's leading experts on the topic. So, Jonah.
Okay, so in today's episode, we're going to look deep into the Nazi-Soviet Pact, why it was signed, what it comprised of, and the ultimate consequences of the agreement. So 1939, Stalin and Hitler met and they signed this revolutionary Nazi-Soviet Pact. It ensured that Hitler would not have to fight a war on two fronts and gave him the upper hand on Poland. But Ian, I'll come to you first. Why did Stalin sign the pact?
Well, Germany and the Soviet Union had actually been on-again, off-again partners for much of the preceding 20 years. They'd signed a secret military agreement in 1922. The Soviet Union had hosted large numbers of German officers at secret bases located inside of Russia. In addition, a lot of German firms had a major role in the industrialization of the Soviet Union. So this wasn't entirely new. There was a long-standing partnership. Yeah, between 1933 and 1939, the Soviet Union had largely pursued a policy known as collective security, partnership with Great Britain and France against Germany. But conditions had changed by the spring of 1939, and Stalin began to seek a reorientation. He was fairly certain that the British and French would not make the sort of military commitments that he required for a formal pact against Germany. And so he turned to the German option beginning in about May 1939. The final agreement would come about in part because Germany offered him terms the British and French would not. Extensive military equipment sales, the destruction of the Baltic states, which he would be able to annex, territory in eastern Poland, and a variety of other key concessions. That's essentially the gist of why Stalin agreed to the terms.
James, do you think because of his fear of Germany, Stalin signed the pact?
Now, me and Ian have discussed this a lot over the years, probably far too many years, actually. But for me, I think Stalin is playing a much bigger game. He's not just so much afraid of Hitler and Nazi Germany, but he's afraid of what's going to happen if they sign a pact with the other powers in Europe. So what if you start getting allies between France and Germany, or, you know, that kind of rumored myth of an idea that Hitler actually wanted to group up with the British Empire, or lo and behold, you ever have something that had America involved as well. Well, that sort of thing doesn't look particularly tempting to Stalin, who with the Soviet Union would pretty much be pretty pale in comparison to that sort of alliance. And I'd really be keen to hear Ian's thoughts more on this. He is the world expert on this topic. But for me, it's more about kind of Stalin's idea of dividing and conquering before it gets too late. And in fact, Ian, wasn't there even a kind of Soviet plan that this would all end up in some great big battle along the Rhine?
Yeah, this is an interesting point. So Stalin was a good Marxist in a lot of ways. And he really saw the Soviet Union as encircled by a hostile capitalist bloc. And his great fear was that all the capitalist countries were going to team up and try to destroy the Soviet Union, to wipe out the birthplace of the communist revolution. He kept seeing all of these conspiracies to entangle the USSR in unwinnable wars or a possible construction of an alliance against the USSR. So he really hoped that a deal with Germany might turn Germany westward and lead to a long destructive war between Great Britain and France. And his foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, even talked jubilantly in 1940, before the Battle of France had begun, He said, yeah, this is going to be great. We'll watch the Germans and French and British bleed each other dry. And once their armies are wiped out, the Red Army can sweep in. There will be a decisive battle in Germany, and we'll plant the flag of communism all across Western Europe. So there were some pretty grand ambitions, perhaps. Under the dreams there, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I think, you know, the Munich Agreement increased Stalin's fears of this, you know, this capitalist revolution in the West, because he wasn't consulted himself, and the agreement demonstrated that Britain and France's powerlessness to stop Hitler would mean that Hitler would want to take over Eastern Europe and Russia. And I think Stalin sort of knew that Hitler wasn't going to stick to this pact for very long, but I think he saw it as a way he could buy time to, you know, rearm the military and prepare for, you know, a German invasion, I suppose.
Yeah,
I think that's a good point. Oh, go ahead, James.
Oh, sorry, I was gonna say, Stalin in no way at all trusted Hitler. Hitler may have given him his word in this treaty, but Stalin knew he wouldn't stick by it. So ultimately, in the long term, this pact bought Stalin time. It gave him a big enough sense of security that he could start working out what to do when Hitler would eventually break his end of the deal.
See, I'm wondering whether or not actually Stalin believes in it a little bit more than people think. You know, I've read books like Absolute War by Chris Bellamy, and me and Chris Bellamy have had a chat of an evening, and, you know, you recount these tales of Stalin going a little bit mad for a few days after he hears of the Nazis invading. I mean, Ian, have you heard much about this? Do you think that Stalin was just playing a much broader game? He was a much cannier thinker, or do you think he had the wool pulled over his eyes a little?
You know, I think we tend to view everything kind of from the perspective of the rapid German victories in 1939, 1940, 1941. It was unanticipated. Everybody thought, not everybody, but the people in key positions, particularly people like Stalin, thought that the Second World War might look a lot like the first. Long, slow, trench-style warfare. There was a lot of uncertainty about what form the war would take. I don't think Stalin anticipated in any way Germany's rapid successes, and I think he believed that he might be able to take advantage of a long war that would look like the first. He talks a lot about turning on and off the spigots, and what he means by that is, under the terms of the agreement, he was going to give a lot of key resources, things like oil, like rubber, to Germany. And there was a sense, well, if Germany was winning in a conflict in Western Europe, he could just kind of slow down delivery. And if they were losing, he could speed it up. And in that way, he could control for an extended period a long-running war in Western Europe. And as a result, I think he was genuinely very, very surprised when Hitler betrayed him in the summer of 1941.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. And obviously, the pact had its consequences. So after that, the pact cleared the way for Hitler to invade Poland on the 1st of September 1939. As James Holland on the last episode said, that this was Hitler's greatest mistake to invade Poland, but he did it nonetheless. And Britain and France obviously demanded he withdrew from Poland or they would declare war. And obviously, you know, the British and the French had no idea about this pact. I don't think they did. I may be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, if they knew about it.
Well, the terms were, there was a secret protocol, so they didn't quite know the exact details of Soviet complicity with Germany. They did not know about the territorial partition. But they actually were essentially well aware of the fact that some sort of arrangement had been reached between the two sides. Part of the agreement was public at the end of August. So the big shock was when the Soviet Union invaded Poland to assist the Germans on September 17th, 1939. That was the real shock, and very, very nearly led the British and French to declare war on the USSR.
Yeah, right, definitely.
Well, I've got a point there, because that's an amazing point, Ian. I mean, let's just consider that for 1 second. Imagine if Great Britain, the British Empire, had declared war on the Soviet Union and on Nazi Germany at the same time. What a different world we might be living in. Ian, how close was that?
Yeah, we've talked about this in years past. So the really scary moment for this being a real possibility came in May 1940. So right about the time Germany attacked France in full, essentially there was a plan in place for the British Air Force to begin bombing oil refineries and wells in southern Russia, which would have obviously brought the USSR as a full participant in the war. They had moved the bombers into position. They had hundreds of thousands of pounds of incendiary bombs ready to go. They'd been flying over the sites. And this was a very near-run thing. Then the collapse of France led to the abandonment of the plan.
Yeah.
But it's very unclear what would have happened in the Second World War had that, in fact, taken place.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a question for you, James. Do you think that the self-interest of Germany and the USSR led to them signing this agreement, even though you know their fundamental beliefs differed so extremely?
Well, as you can probably hear through this microphone, sadly there is a car alarm going off outside, but I will try my best through this chaos to answer your important and succinct question. I think that this was just all about political bargaining and just trying to make sure there were contingency plans set up. Like I said, in terms of Stalin's motivation, I do think it was part of that broader great power game. And Ian's exactly said it. You know, there was almost this idea that they could control the war as it developed, which if you look at any conflict throughout history, war doesn't quite work that easily. You know, it's 20 years this year since the start of the war in Afghanistan, which was meant to have been over by October, November 2001. So there's a reminder for you of just how wars don't really plan out the way in which invaders want them to. But there's another point here. So that was Stalin's point of view, but let's go through to Hitler's. Now, as they started to rearm during the interwar years, they'd used a lot of their resources in trying to build up their military. And so they really did want to make sure they had, and I'm going to steal a term from Ian here, they wanted to have some strategic depth into the Soviet Union so that they could have supplies from the Soviet Union passed through. So there was some money to be made here as well, but a bit of extra security. You've got to remember from the First World War, there'd also been the blockade on Germany. Germany had been rendered largely impotent as a result of this. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians dying as well. The fact it had put a chokehold on their economy. Hitler was about bringing some level of strategic and political independence back to Germany alongside that pride. So this sort of deal with the devil, or as perhaps Ian might call it with his new book, The Faustian Bargain, was all about trying to make sure that Germany had these contingencies and options.
Yeah, I mean, that it definitely relates to strongly to, you know, one part of Hitler's foreign policy, which was gaining Lebensraum, living space in the East, and expanding this German Reich, the empire to last 1,000 years, obviously only lasting 12. But I think that really, it does, you know, relate to that quite a lot. And Jonah?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt Hitler doesn't sign this act for a long-term alliance with communist USSR. The two ways of life, Nazism and communism, are just complete polar opposites. They're nowhere near compatible with each other. So this pact for neither side really is long-term. Stalin knows Hitler has his sights on the USSR. That was one of Hitler's largest ambition to spread across Eastern Europe and then, as you said, make his massive empire. So it is almost definitely about long-term self-interest rather than friendliness, I guess.
Yeah, there's no friendliness. I mean, I suppose it's kind of like, you know, content with being allies, you know, that sort of, you know, just kind of being acquaintances, I suppose. But none of them were ever really going to hold it down too much. And it was never really going to be, as you said, a long-term thing. And you know, obviously Hitler being the crazy, fanatical, ideologically driven maniac he was, he believed that the Aryans and the Germanics were far superior to the ethnic Slavs in Russia, and he had every intention to, you know, ethnically cleanse them as he did to the Jews in, I suppose he planned on doing to the Jews in World War II.
Ian, wasn't there a little bit more friendliness than that during the times of the pact itself. Because if I recall, didn't Stalin start to make some changes himself that may well have been in line with what Hitler would have wanted, especially in regards to the Jews?
Yes, it's interesting, you know, that they are very hostile ideologically, obviously. Germany, Nazi Germany had eliminated the Communist Party. Obviously, fascism was a word of great contempt in the USSR, but they actually viewed each other as more ideologically compatible and similar than either saw themselves in relation to liberal democracies. They talk about this, Stalin and Molotov, when they meet in August 1939, that they're both opposed to decadent capitalist West in a variety of ways. In fact, some senior Nazis refer to themselves as national Bolshevists. So a sense that essentially the communist program wasn't so bad necessarily if it wasn't internationalized in some way, shape, or form. And indeed, Stalin adapted the communist platform to a degree as well. So when he begins to express interest in partnership with Germany, he appoints a new foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov. He replaces his Jewish foreign minister, who'd been in charge before, Litvinov. And Molotov's first order is to purge the foreign ministry of Jews as a signal to Hitler. And this begins a long period of official anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union that continued all the way through Stalin's death. So obviously they're you know, fighting in the streets of Berlin before the Nazis come to power, but they share certain elements of a worldview that do express themselves, especially during the partnership when they're holding conferences about the best ways to suppress Polish independence movements and talking about interrogation techniques, and their secret police have some things in common as well.
What do you both think about that? Because as you come to doing your exams, and I know that you're doing this podcast to kind of aid in lockdown and to help with GCSEs, does that kind of help you understand in a bit more detail about some of the motivations behind this, perhaps how just important it was to Stalin that he was willing to throw even his most senior Jewish officials under the bus here? Does it make you rethink kind of some of the motivations that were going on?
Well, it seems almost absurd. You know, we've gone in class in depth into the Weimar Republic, looking at all the ways how communism was crushed in Germany. We looked at the Spartacus Revolution and how that was bloodily destroyed. We looked at the Reichstag Fire Decree and the Enabling Act and the banning of the... So to think that there would be some hints of a Stalin-Hitler alliance is just throws a spanner into the works, I guess.
You just wouldn't think it, having done our sort of side of the GCSE course. You just wouldn't think that, you know, these two polar opposite countries in terms of political ideology would ever even dream of cooperating. But I suppose at this time it seemed like the best way forward for both of them. And after, obviously, you know, long negotiations, they managed to come to agreement to partition Poland, which is something they both wanted. Obviously, Stalin wanted to expand communism into Eastern Europe, as he did after, you know, after World War II ended, you know, the Eastern Bloc and the Iron Curtain. And you know, both of them, it's quite interesting because both of them want to expand their empires, but it's kind of at the expense of one another almost. Who's gonna fall first? It's obviously, Hitler did, having lost the war, but you know, at that point in time, that's kind of, I think that's what the thought was.
So a kind of my enemy's enemy is my friend, in the short term, at least.
Yeah, I suppose so. In wartime.
And Ian, hadn't the Soviets even been portraying the Nazis as kind of the sworn enemy in their films up until this point as well?
Yeah, there's this great anecdote that when Ribbentrop arrives in Moscow in August 1939 to negotiate the pact, they wanted to lay out a bunch of Nazi flags to kind of greet him. They couldn't find any except on a movie set where the Nazis were the bad guys outside of the city. So they take them off the set and set them up all over town to try to welcome Ribbentrop to town. But obviously, to the Soviet public as well as the German public, this was much more of a shock than it was for senior policymakers in either state.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a source here, actually, which is from Stalin, that he made in a speech in 1941 when, I think, you know, Germany invaded them and the tides turned. And he said, it will be asked how it was possible that the Soviet government signed a non-aggression pact with so deceitful a nation, with such criminals as Hitler and Ribbentrop. And then it kind of goes a bit further. We secured peace for our country for 18 months, which enabled us to make military preparations. What do you guys make of this source? What does it tell you?
So I believe this is this from his early July 1941 speech?
I don't know.
So this is essentially Stalin. The story is that he may or may not have had a nervous breakdown when Hitler betrays him. He disappears to his country villa. Again, we're not entirely clear. Most of this is based on Khrushchev, who didn't like Stalin a whole lot after Stalin's death. But in any case, he basically just disappears from public view for about 3 weeks. He has Molotov announce, we just got attacked. But then he finally comes on the air and he gives the speech where he says, essentially, brothers, sisters, he starts in this very familiar way. He says, essentially, almost apologizes, defends his partnership with Nazi Germany, and then announces this is going to be a war to the bitter end, the destruction of fascism, etc. So it has to be understood in that context, because only about 10 months earlier, Stalin had been discussing the possibility of a full-fledged military alliance with Nazi Germany in exchange for essentially control of the Middle East and much of Southeast Asia, or Southeastern Europe, excuse me, the Balkans. The Soviet willingness to participate in all sorts of things alongside Nazi Germany, even joint military operations, there was a degree of enthusiasm in November, December 1940, only about 6 months earlier. So I would read it in that light, the bitter light of hindsight in the summer of 1941.
You can understand why he had a nervous breakdown as well. I mean, just think how, well, obviously you've been duped. We can perhaps say that, but you've seen how German forces have rushed through France. If you're expecting that is going to be another Somme, then you're going to be pretty worried about what's coming your way. What was it? Was it 6 weeks? 6 weeks it took France to fall. Absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, the French didn't just capitulate. The French didn't just fall by the wayside. We have that kind of famous Simpsons quote of these cheese-eating surrender monkeys of the French during the Second World War. But 100,000 French troops were killed during that period. Six weeks trying to defend their country. And then, of course, you've got the British who have to flee at this point, and the French defending them until the very end as they're trying to make their way off the beaches. And all of this stuff, as you're moving through, really shows you that you've seen the French and the British Expeditionary Force pushed back by this formidable German military, and now they're coming your way. You can kind of understand why you need to take a few weeks to regroup and gather.
Yeah, I mean,
oh, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, asking James, do you think that the French sort of collapsed so easily because they because of their weak government, the weak political system at the time, you know, with the coalition governments and, you know, being in political chaos? Do you think that played a part? Perhaps.
Yeah, it's a good point, Charlie. I think France was divided at that time, politically especially, and in some ways militarily, but I do not think in any way we should underestimate just the sheer quality and novelty of German strategy here. The way in which they'd employed their armored divisions, along with drugging their own soldiers with methamphetamines to make sure they can go 52 hours without sleep and rush through into France and take the country. You know, all of this is pretty new to warfare, and it's been used in one hell of an effective way. And of course, the great irony here is that Ian, had the Soviets and the Germans in the 1920s and 30s, they'd been working on some of these strategies and technologies together, right?
Almost every German tank or aircraft design used in the first stages of the war had actually come out of the secret facilities located in Russia in one way, shape, or form.
I mean, that's so,
essentially, without 20 years of on again, off again partnership, the Second World War would not have even been possible for Germany to start.
Well, there's another point there then, because Stalin knew exactly what was coming their way, because they'd bloody well helped them develop it.
And another part of this story, which I think is forgotten, and maybe it comes up in your course, is the devastating impact of the Great Purges, which is a related phenomenon. So beginning in 1937, Stalin basically began shooting huge numbers of his senior officers or imprisoning them. Somewhere between 7 and 11% of all Soviet officers disappear in this period. He shoots essentially most of his very senior commanders, including the deputy commissar of defense. At this time, all the guys in charge of training, many senior engineers, they just disappear. Part of the reason is because a lot of them had been trained by the Germans. He was not sure about their loyalty. But this meant for Stalin, you can imagine the fear that grips his heart in 1941. He has very few experienced senior officers. There was not a single person who graduated from the main military academy holding essentially a combat command in the entire Red Army in the summer of 1941. Because he'd arrested or shot so many of them, they were desperately trying to train officers to replace them, but it's a long, slow process to develop that kind of expertise. And he knows what's coming, and he is not convinced the Red Army is ready to meet it.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you a question, James. Well, could you enlighten our listeners as to how the USSR coped with the German attack? Because although we don't do this specifically in our the course, it's still quite important for our understanding of how things ended up.
Well, they did what Russia does, and they absorbed it, and they absorbed it. And they absorbed it up until a point where they tried to hold it. And then you let the winter set in.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you know, but the winters in Russia aren't that great.
No. That's why they beat them, because they'll keep it. So, no. I'm not sure when exactly the attack was, the first attack. Was that in the summer?
June 22nd, 1941.
Yeah. Which was obviously carefully planned out by Germany, because they knew that if they were going to take Russia down, they were going to have to do it in the summer without the snow and the ice and the frostbite. Unfortunately for them, the Red Army, as you said, James, stayed strong and took them to the winter. And that's when it sort of all started to go wrong for Germany. Hitler became more increasingly paranoid. And then the tide started to turn. Britain had the Soviet Union on their side, which was a huge plus. And the Japanese had obviously bombed Pearl Harbor, which meant the USA were now also on their side. And all of a sudden, it's all started to come back on Hitler. Hitler's starting to get worried about it all.
I don't know what you think, Ian, but I think that perhaps it's... I get that narrative, and I think that those are important points. But I think it was also a little bit more of a finer line than that when it came to the Soviets and the Nazis, because you look at places like the siege of Leningrad and you see just the utter hardship that these people were put through and the task that was faced by the Red Army. I mean, the creation of ice roads and, you know, just creating entire new ways to try and feed the besieged city of Leningrad. You know, people were eating their own dogs at this point. I mean, there's cases of cannibalism within the cities. I mean, it is down to the bare bones. Thousands and thousands of people dead through an incredibly harsh winter as well. And I don't know, Ian, do you think it's the winter that helps turn the tide here? Or is it the winter that gives the Soviet Union time to start getting supplies from its new allies?
Yeah, there are a bunch of different factors at play here. I think everything you said is very correct. You know, British aid plays a significant role in helping boost Russian defenses around Moscow in December 1941. The reality is that the Red Army desperately needed breathing space, and a fairly early arrival of winter and a heavy frost really helped. And the Soviets were losing 44,000 men a day in the opening phases of the war. And the fact that you had this incredibly cold winter, one of the coldest on record, it was so cold that the Germans had to light fires under their tanks and planes just to get the engine started by November 1941 when they're launching Operation Typhoon to try to take Moscow. And a lot of people argue they started too late, or the weather essentially saved the day, and it certainly played a pretty big role. I think one of the other factors is The Japanese were very seriously considering invading the Eastern Soviet Union. They did not. They attacked Pearl Harbor instead. That decision was only made in late summer 1941. If they had, the USSR would not have been able to transfer over 1 million troops from Siberia to defend Moscow. I think that was a huge, huge factor in slowing down the German advance.
We're going to have to wrap up there before we go over time. So there we have it. We've gone deep into the Nazi-Soviet pact. We've looked at the start of the Second World War, what it currently looks like for Hitler's Germany and Stalin's USSR. Ian, James, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been absolutely amazing and your help has been invaluable. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to have you on again sometime soon. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you both.
So we're going to swiftly move on to today's political discussion. And I'm delighted to announce we are joined yet again by two guests to help us debate. So I introduce Darsha. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you for coming on. And Natalie.
Hi.
Hello. And we're going to have a little debate on capitalism versus socialism and whether or not a socialist government would suit the UK or whether indeed a socialist government would suit any country in the world for that matter. I want to start today's debate by referring to a poll carried out by American organization Gallup. Now, this poll concluded that 57% of all Democrats in the United States of America and 51% of all young people in America aged 18 to 29 were pro-socialist. Now, this to me is quite frankly absurd. How anyone could envy the lifestyles of hunger and of an authoritarian government such as was seen in the Soviet Union, in Mao Zedong's China, and even in current day Venezuela, how any of those livelihoods could be envied is quite frankly berserk to think. However, the poll does not stop there. What's perhaps most telling is that, as I'm sure we can all agree, one thing that socialism makes clear is that it believes that governments should hold more authority, that the power of governments should be increased. Yet of these voters who said they were pro-socialist, only 8% of them believe that the government at that current moment in time had too little power. So therefore we have two contrasting messages. It suggests that well over half of the young people in America are pro-socialist, yet hardly any of them actually stand for some of the largest socialist values. So that raises the question, as more and more nowadays young people are seen hand in hand with the idea of socialism and the endless temptations the ideology offers, is it fair to assume that every single one of these young socialists actually know and understand the lifestyle they are supporting? Or is it just based on a bed of lies without looking at the actual fact and looking at what might seem on paper the nicest way to live? A world free of difference, free of inequality, and free of any harm. So, how much about socialism do these young people who claim to be socialist supporters actually know about socialism? And that's not me trying to be condescending or looking down on anyone. But how aware are socialist supporters actually of socialism? And I'm joined by two not out and out socialists, but Natalie and Darsha do view themselves more on the left side of politics. So who should I come to first? Darsha, what are your thoughts on the poll and what I've just said?
I think that the examples you gave, like the USSR and stuff, they're not necessarily socialist. They're much more like, well, they obviously are totalitarian, but you know, like Stalin and the leaders of the USSR were much more, well, they claimed to be communist, but they weren't even communist. They didn't follow the idea of a stateless, classless, moneyless society. If anything, they're really state capitalist societies. So I'm not really sure they're great arguments to use against socialism. And also, did that American poll like give a definition of socialism which is in line with Stalin's definition of communism? Or is it more in line with the ideas of like workers owning the means of production or having more control over them rather than the idea of like everything being stateless, classless and moneyless?
That's not what socialism is. That form of socialism took form in a totalitarian one-party state in which the workers would work for the benefit of the state. So in a way, that is socialism. Workers, it's collectivism. It's working for the benefit of the state. And considering the amount of lives lost, millions of officers and citizens killed by Stalin, whoever...
It wasn't socialism. It didn't follow any idea of like what Marx or Engels or any socialist thinkers said. It was Stalin's interpretation of it, which just is evident.
So,
you read the Communist Manifesto.
Dasha, how would you define socialism?
I'd say the socialism which I find myself agreeing with most is the idea of workers having more control, not necessarily government having more control in the long run, but government implementing strategies to make sure that private corporations don't control everything and don't use their power to pressure government. I think that things do need to be more equal, and that would be linked in with some sort of socialism, but it's not necessarily, you know, the extremes of, you know, scrapping everything we have now and scrapping every single part of what we consider like our capitalist state, because I don't think that would work.
Okay, I hear that. Natalie, what are your thoughts on what Dasha's just said and what I've introduced with?
I completely agree with what Dasha has said, and I think when people think of socialism, as you've given examples of very extremist, you know, forms of socialism, that's just not how it is, especially nowadays when everything, even both left and right wing people on the spectrum, is become more centralized. You can't argue with that. So it's not as, what's the word for it? Yeah, but I agree with Dasha Lily.
Okay, but if I was considering to vote for a socialist leader in the UK, for example, Jeremy Corbyn maybe, or Keir Starmer, and if I was to ask myself, is there any evidence of socialism working? I can't think of a time across history when, in put into practice, socialism has truly worked and has given, was shown in a utopian society, and has people, and the people have been truly at ease with this ideology, which obviously takes many forms, but none of which I can see have worked. And from my point of view, why would I trust something I don't know that works, and why would I not put my faith into something that does, which is economic liberalism? I ask you that.
Well, when you give the example of Keir Starmer being a socialist or someone who has socialist views which you could vote for, I wouldn't say that you haven't seen his idea of socialism. For example, like, within this capitalist society, it's managed capitalism. So many socialist principles, policies have been poured into it thanks to the Labour Party, you know, throughout the last, you know, over the years. So many socialist policies, like, for example, like, you know, the NHS, like in 1948, that was, you know, these things all to do with socialism. You know, they're not hardcore communism, but they are socialist ideas. And they, if anything, they uphold capitalism. So you have lived under these policies. And I don't see why you wouldn't vote for somebody like that.
Can we all agree that socialism means a more or less state-run market. Yes?
I agree then.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Do we not also all agree that the freer the market, the freer the people?
No.
Explain.
Why don't you?
Because it's not necessarily that, you know, if, you know, in principle, a free market sounds great. And, you know, like there's nothing wrong with it in principle, but when you push it into practice, you know, who does it benefit? Does it benefit the workers of every single country?
It gives people, any person, an opportunity. That means anyone, not everyone, but it can work for anyone.
But it can't work for anyone. If you grow up in a capitalist state with a single mother and a poor education, it doesn't work for you. If you don't have that, it just doesn't work. It's so unlikely to work, and it's so unfair.
What a free market does is it provides an incentive of market prices, profit and loss. And without that, it's in human nature to be the most successful you can be.
To be driven.
But yeah, but it's not about ensuring equality of, like, you know, outcome. It's about equality of opportunity. Like, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure many people are driven. I'm sure most people are driven. But there are so many people who are driven, but it doesn't go anywhere for them, no matter how hard they try, because it's just not set up.
It won't go for anyone.
But it can't. That's how
economy.
That's not how it is in practice.
Well, I disagree with that. And I could say the same thing about socialism. In principle, the idea of everyone, the idea of the state-owned economy, people living a more equal lifestyle is very appealing. And I definitely, you know, under my morals, I would agree with that, you know, proposition. But in practice, as we've already said, it doesn't work.
But I don't believe it. Practice, or not really. If you're talking about like an extreme, severe form of sort of borderline communism that hasn't been put into practice, that's been state capitalism, totalitarianism. It's not following the manifesto. It's not following what Marx said. And if we're talking about like socialism and like on a lesser scale, and like what Labour politicians, most mainstream Labour politicians believe it to be, then, like, so many of those policies have been put into practice and they can continue to be.
But should we put our faith into the individual person? That's my point. How can you put your faith into an individual person? So you can, for example, you can have the government having more control, which is, you know, it's not fine, but at least there is a sense of guidance. But when you put it into the hands of the workers and the people, it becomes a bit of a free-for-all, effectively.
But why is that any different to wealthy individuals who own massive corporations? Isn't that a free-for-all too, but just with the rich?
Yes, but at least I'm accepting it is going to be like that. There is going to be an economic hierarchy. I'm accepting that is,
Natalie?
That is natural.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's always that we can't. I agree that there has to be a little bit, a certain amount of inequality for a society to work. I do agree with that. And going back to what Charlie said about how can we trust, I think there's general distrust in the government and politicians. We know this. The over the years, the amount of voters has fallen drastically. But I think we need to create a system where people know they can trust the government, because the government is putting trust back into the people. It needs to be a two-way thing, because it's often the case where the people at the top, the wealthiest, you know, the politicians are wealthy. They're from usually from good economic backgrounds. They are sometimes hindered by the view that what they think will work for everyone, you know, because they see the life that they've lived, and they want to, they don't really see people from working class backgrounds. I'm not saying always, that's why I said sometimes hindered, but yeah, that's why.
I think that socialism fails because it kills and destroys the human spirit. That seems dramatic, but like I said, it's in human nature to do the best for yourself. And you can't go asking the people in Cuba living in homemade rafts and boats, whether they'd rather live in a free market capitalist society where their opportunities are so much greater than what they currently are, and expect them to prefer to live in the socialist, in the socialism, in the socialist regime they're currently living in. And so you say that capitalism doesn't bring about opportunities, but I couldn't see any more lies in that statement.
No, you've taken all words wrong. Capitalism does bring about opportunities, but to get those opportunities, it's so much harder. Let's say that person or whoever has come from Cuba to England, for example, you know, and they want to start making their way up the social ladder. It's going to be so much more difficult for them to do that. The jobs such as journalism, which was so before much an easier job to get into, like an occupation, which, and it's a very important job because journalism not dictates, but it puts across views from, you know, the establishment. There's a lot of things that play into it. It's just so much harder because we know that the person who went to Eton, who's they've got those connections, you know, they've got that social circle to get them into those places. It's going to be so much more easier for that person to get that job rather than someone who's just come in or someone who's working class to then build their way up, especially because to get some higher paid jobs, you need to do internships for a longer period of time where you have to sort of, you know, rely on funding, and it's just harder.
Okay, I like to make a point as well, and this is not me defending Margaret Thatcher on a personal level, but her economic policy to me seems very appealing. My dad came from a fairly working class background. His parents worked in the markets of Harrow and Brixton. And Thatcher implemented a scheme called government assisted places at private schools to help kids from more disadvantaged backgrounds, to help pay the fees. They would pay, I think, half to two thirds of the fees of those schools to allow those kids to go to those schools and give them opportunities. And that benefited my dad and his brother massively. That gave them both a huge opportunity in life. So when you say that capitalism isn't about opportunity, Margaret Thatcher is the most prime example of the economic liberal philosophy. And that scheme from 1981 to 1997 until Tony Blair gave a lot of opportunity to people from those sort of backgrounds.
Darsha, you haven't spoken in a while.
You know, I think the thing with Thatcher is, like, you can compliment her policies as much as you want, but, you know, unemployment did rocket up, and I obviously don't have the figures, but unemployment hit, like, massive. It was just, like, it didn't work for the majority of people. Like, that's great that it helped your dad, but it didn't help most working people at all. It just didn't. Like, it just didn't help working people.
Yeah, well, I mean, Thatcher's biggest mistake wasn't taking away the mining industry. It was not reskilling. It was not reskilling those workers and giving them the training to be able to perform in other jobs across every sector, which I think obviously was her biggest mistake. But in principle, the mining industry wasn't doing anything for the country. And when you talk about unemployment, it's all right. It's okay. You know, everyone can be employed, for example. But if you're working many, many hours a week on a very low wage, what does employment mean?
It gives you a sense of being, a sense of worth. But obviously, I agree, people shouldn't be working for many hours a week on a low wage. But they need jobs. People want jobs.
Even if it won't provide them with the basic necessities.
Well, no, but then what do you suggest instead?
Well, I suggest that we can provide... Okay, this is an example from the 1980s, right? But what Thatcher could have done was provided jobs for those people and reskilled them. That's my point. But
But reskilled them in what? That's the problem. There's just not enough jobs.
Okay,
like,
I don't want to create a Thatcher debate. So let's move back to socialism. You look at countries before and after socialism. Let's take Russia, for example. I don't think we can fully say it was full communism, the USSR. But Russia, for example, is one of the world's wealthiest countries in terms of natural resources. Yeah, as some of the world's largest reserves of oil, natural gas, diamonds, and gold. I think I don't know the full list of Russia's exports, but you know what I'm saying. Its valuable farmlands, lakes, rivers, all these resources should make it one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Yet Russia, on a whole, remains poor. Where natural resources are helpful, the ultimate resources of any country are the unlimited resources of its people, human resources. And for the decades of mistreatment and the suspension of civil liberties that Russian people lived through during the times of the Soviet Union, its aftermath is still very much in effect to today. Socialism leaves an awful footprint on the country at the current time of the socialist government, and even now, decades since the
collapse
of the USSR. Any comments on that?
The USSR, well, firstly, the USSR wasn't socialism.
What was it if it wasn't socialism?
It was a communist state, but I think it was not communist, as close to socialism
as we have ever seen.
I don't think so. I think they called themselves a communist state, but evidently they were not a communist state. They were much
closer to some Soviet Socialist Republics.
Sorry?
United Soviet Socialist Republics.
Yeah, but I could name my
I'm just saying it's in the name, so it's clearly.
But that's like saying the National Socialist Party of Germany was a socialist party, when evidently it was a fascist party.
Would you say Cuba is socialist? Would you say Venezuela is socialist?
I wouldn't say they're socialist, no.
Are they also fascist?
Are you talking about the Cuban Revolution or Cuba now?
Cuba now. Cuba for the past however many years. Not much has changed.
Sorry?
So like I said, Cuba, the people living in Cuba, the people living in Venezuela, in their handmade boats and rafts, do not think that their way of life is the best possible way of life. And you just can't argue that, Charlie.
Yeah, so when it comes to Venezuela, 10% over the last, in this century, have emigrated outwards to other countries, mainly the United States, 3 to 4 million people.
So 10% of the population of Venezuela.
10%. 10% of the entire population has fled because of socialism, because they were living in disease-infested houses, rats crawling around everywhere, rotten meat being sold on the streets for almost nothing, hyperinflation like we saw in Weimar Germany previously on the podcast, and all because of Hugo Chavez and the socialist state that Venezuela finds itself.
I think what's really poignant in that point you make is how the majority of them are migrating to the US. And as the former centrally planned economies move towards free markets, capitalism, and democracy, the role model they are given, they look up to the United States for guidance and support. The USA has an unparalleled 250? Have they been around for 250?
Well, population.
No. How many? When was the US?
Oh, it's been,
doesn't
yeah.
matter. For
yeah,
250
years,
years
yeah.
tradition of an open market and limited government power. And I think the United States is uniquely qualified to be guiding the light in this worldwide transition to freedom and liberty. And the US, I know for a fact, has never been socialist. But they act as a role model. Darsha, did he go?
Sorry, like, doesn't the US have its own problems, which some may say are just awful? Like, they literally had an insurrection at the Capitol building a few weeks ago. I wouldn't say they're a content country.
That's nothing to do with the capitalist and democratic.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who called himself president,
not because of the capitalist values held by the
I'm not talking about Trump himself. I'm wondering why so many people, so many of them, like working class people, like jumped on behind him. And I think a lot of them are so dissatisfied with the way the country is working, the way the economy is working, the way everything is working.
Trump is very right wing.
No, I know he is. I'm not saying he's a good person. He's an awful person.
Well, no, being right wing doesn't make him an awful person.
No, he is an awful person.
He is an awful person. I do not doubt that. But
I think he's alt-right, which makes him an awful person.
That's up for debate. Whether he is alt-right or not, he's never spoken outly about that. And there is no real evidence that he is, because the alt-right is a racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic.
So he's not racist.
I'm not saying he's not racist, but that's a completely different kettle of fish to what we're discussing now. Is, you know, capitalism versus socialism.
But I'm saying there are so many working people in that capitalist country who are so dissatisfied with things at the moment.
I don't think they can blame that on
capitalism. Would they have a better life in the Soviet Union or Venezuela? Probably
but
not.
The Soviet Union is not...
You're using the minority to speak for the majority here.
Okay.
We can do the same thing. It's not given a playing field.
Why not then? Because there's no real example of capitalist...
Okay, I asked this question. The stat Charlie just raised, 10% of the entire population of Venezuela in the past however many years have migrated to the US. How many Americans living in a capitalist American society have migrated to Venezuela
to choose to live in
a socialist society?
No, okay, that's right. But I think the problem with countries like Venezuela and countries which say they have socialist regimes is that, I mean, if we're debating the idea of like communism or revolution or whatever, which has got them into this position, then Marx didn't envision that countries, he envisioned that countries which had already like had their industrialization and who were like really progressing, they had an established bourgeoisie, blah, blah, blah. He envisioned that they would be the countries which would then like have revolutions.
So who's to say Marx isn't speaking out of his arse?
No, but I'm saying if you're talking about revolution, you're talking about communism, why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
The whole original idea of it is it would come from an established, developed economy. It wouldn't come from countries which weren't so established and developed. So that may be why it didn't
work.
But I'm not defending the idea of revolution. I don't necessarily agree with revolution. I'm trying to talk about socialist reforms. That's what I agree with.
Okay, Natalie?
Yeah, no, and I was going to say, has Venezuela gotten far enough for us to be arguing whether socialism has gone them a long way? I feel like they, as a country, haven't had the same opportunities as, for example, America. I don't really know much about Venezuela. I need to do my research on that. But from what I can think of the top of my head, has it had the same economic opportunities to sort of... like develop into somewhere like, for example, the UK here, very big contrasting differences, but have they had the opportunities to get them to the place where they can then put in those socialist or policies or ideas? No, I don't think so, because as you said...
You're right, they haven't, but that's because of socialism. That's as a result of the state control.
No, she makes a very good point, Natalie, because... You know, who's to say if after all the capitalist economies crash, who's to say only the socialist countries won't survive. We are going to have to wrap up there with some final thoughts, because we will go over time.
I just want to make one final point.
Yeah.
One final point, Jonah. It's to do with the UK in comparison to China. China is a self-declared communist state, probably socialist. The GNI of the UK, gross national income per capita, is $35,000 per year. And the gross national income of China is just $3,000 per year.
But obviously the UK is a more developed country. It's a place which I'm happy to live in. China's not a communist country. China's a state capitalist country.
Yeah, and it's so corrupt. You can't... This is why I refer to, say, referring as extremes. You're letting sort of the... How do I explain it? It's not the same, as Dasha said. That's not socialism. That is coming under, authoritarian capitalism. Yeah. So
it's just not a good example. That's not what I agree with. That's not a debate we should be having, because I don't think anyone here agrees with the way China's economy is working, the way China's government's working.
There's no evidence to suggest that socialism would work. There is no evidence.
Well, it depends what you mean by socialism, because I believe we can have a more socialist society. I'm not saying socialism but socialism, I think you're mistaking it of communism here, because I don't think socialism is such an extreme that we haven't seen before. We've seen so many socialist policies within our capitalist society. So I don't know what's to say why we can't have even more policies that should be in line with some which the Labour Party agree with, which Keir Starmer agrees with. And they're not extreme ideas at all.
Exactly. It just needs to be intertwined with what we have in society now. And, that includes parts of the Tory government, Labour
government. We are where we are. We're not going to have a full-blown revolution.
Yeah, revolution, and just say, right, tomorrow everyone's working, of everything.
It's just about making equality of opportunity slightly more real.
Okay. What you're saying could be understandable. Thank you. We are there going to have to wrap up with some final thoughts. In my opinion, socialism is a temptation. It can be seen as an oasis to idealists our age, who haven't quite, this is again, it's going to sound quite condescending, who haven't quite got the full grasp of how the world runs. Socialism offers this sentence: give up a little of your freedom and I will give you a little more security. I think for the majority of the people in that poll, which I started today's debate off, I think they will always think that the grass is always greener somewhere else. Natalie, Dasha, Lily, thank you very much for joining us today. We hope it hasn't been too unbearable. And who
this
knows?
We might have this debate again. We are a little more experienced, hopefully.
Thank you very much. And that concludes the sixth episode of the Historic Present podcast. And now we talk directly to you. If you have, we hope you might have felt inspired or encouraged by our many wonderful speakers such as Hugo, Sean, Xavi, Dasha and Natalie during our political sections, or any one of the wonderful historians who have agreed to come on. If you would like to get involved, either talk about history or politics, do get in touch with @thehistoricpresentpod. On Instagram. We'd love to have as many of you as possible, and any support would be great. So thanks for listening, and we'd love to hear from you.
Cheers for that, folks.